Hi, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of Latino USA. We all love great stories. And great stories are what we pride ourselves in delivering to you every week. Latino USA presents a mix of reporting on culture and politics, diverse voices, and coverage of current and emerging issues, featuring stories that will make you think and maybe even inspire you. Listen to Latino USA on your favorite podcast app from PRX.
American reporter Evan Gershkovich has now spent a year in jail in Russia. His Wall Street Journal colleagues are doing what they can to keep focus on his case.
We have been running for him. We have been swimming for him. We've done a 24-hour readathon of his work.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also ahead, the UN started counting migrant deaths after a horrific accident 10 years ago. It's only gotten worse.
One in three recorded as dead and missing come from countries in conflict or countries with big refugee populations.
And when your name gets auto-corrected to something else entirely, not a nice feeling.
For example, there's an amazing woman called Montserrat. Her name changes to Munsterrat. How awful is that?
A UK campaign to diversify autocorrect. That's ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here with us. 1 year ago, Evan Gershkovich, a Wall Street Journal reporter and U.S. citizen, was on a reporting trip in eastern Russia. His driver dropped him off at a steakhouse. 2 hours later, calls wouldn't go through to Gershkovich's phone, and his editors knew something wasn't right. Russian security forces had detained him on suspicion of espionage. It's a charge U.S. officials vehemently deny. This week, a Moscow court extended Gershkovich's detention by 3 months. U.S. Ambassador to Russia Lynn Tracy spoke to reporters after the hearing.
Evan has displayed remarkable resilience and strength in the face of this grim situation. But it is time for the Russian government to let Evan go.
Gershkovich's employer, The Wall Street Journal, has relentlessly pushed to get him released. Paul Beckett is a senior editor at the Journal, and he told me what Gershkovich's life in prison is like.
I'd say he's holding up remarkably well under very trying circumstances. So he is in a cell with a roommate 23 hours a day. He has 1 hour of exercise a day in a courtyard that's about the same size as his cell, so it's sort of six paces in each direction. He's shown incredible fortitude during the year he's been there. He exercises, he meditates, he writes letters, he reads, and he's kept his equilibrium, and we're very grateful for that.
Is he able to receive correspondence and visitors?
He can write letters and receive letters, and that has been a vital source of communication, especially for him and his family here in Philadelphia. Dow Jones, the parent company of the Journal, have lawyers who see him once a week, and Ambassador Tracy sees him occasionally as well.
As I mentioned, this week, a Moscow court extended Evan's detention by 3 months. What does that signal?
We've seen this for a year now. Every 2 or 3 months, the authorities request another extension. It's granted by the court. We appeal it. It's turned down. And it's supposed to be an investigative phase, but really, we don't know what's going to happen next. We've seen no evidence at all. We assume there will be a trial at some point, but we haven't been given any trial date or any details. So it's pretty foggy when you look ahead.
So some Americans that have been held in Russia, like Brittany Griner, their detentions have come to an end with prisoner swaps. We know that these are opaque processes involving government-to-government negotiations, but can you tell us anything about a prisoner swap here, if that's in discussion at all?
We heard in early December that the State Department had made an offer for Evan's release and for the release of Paul Whelan, who, of course, has been there for 5 years on similar charges. The Russians rejected that, but then we saw President Putin mention Evan twice after that, once in his annual press conference and once in his interview with Tucker Carlson. And since then, we've heard statements from both sides saying that conversations are underway. So, you know, we are hopeful that that will be a vehicle by which he can be released. We just need to see it happen now because 1 year is already too long.
Can you shed any more light on what might be happening behind the scenes to win Evan's release?
We don't see all the details on this. Obviously, President Putin referenced in one of his comments the profile of someone who fit a KGB assassin, FSB assassin, who has in custody in Berlin. And we've reported, and others have reported, that that is a person that Russia is interested in getting back. So that obviously is a situation that we are interested in, and maybe that's the way to do it. I'm sure there are other ways that it could be done.
It's widely believed that Russia takes hostages as a way to get some of their prisoners out of jails around the world to use in negotiations and prisoner swaps. Is that being talked about in this case?
I think it's clearly what it is. I mean, Evan is not a spy. I think you've seen a pattern of Paul Whelan, Trevor Reed, Brittany Griner, Evan, even since Evan, also Kermasheva for Radio Free Europe, another American who's now in Russian jail. So yes, Russia is amassing hostages, we believe, with a view to trying to trade innocent people for people it wants back from prison in the West.
A handful of U.S. reporters from major outlets are still reporting from Russia. Don't they risk ending up like Evan?
I think it's a very risky proposition to be reporting from Russia now, wherever you're from. One of the things that we did see after Evan's detention was a withdrawal of a lot of reporters. It deprived the world of fact-based reporting. It's pretty vital when you look around and see how much Russia is involved in. That's information that we need, and it certainly has been sharply curtailed in the last 12 months.
You said that Evan is getting by as best as he can, as well as could be expected right now. What is it about him or his spirit that is allowing him to keep soldiering on?
Well, we knew he was a great reporter, which is why we hired him in early 2022. We've also learned that he's an extraordinary young man. You know, he's a very thoughtful person. He arranged for flowers to be sent to his mother and sister and other women in his life on International Women's Day. He also is of Russian heritage. He was born here, but his parents emigrated here from the former Soviet Union. So he knows Russian traditions. He's spent his whole career in Russia, so he's familiar with the terrain, and he speaks fluent Russian. So I think all of those things make his time in jail, you know, slightly less disorienting than it would otherwise be.
What is your newsroom doing today to reflect this anniversary?
So we're doing a lot this week. We have been running for him. We have been swimming for him. Evan and his sister used to go and visit their grandparents in Brighton Beach in Brooklyn. And it turns out there are Brighton beaches all over the world. So we went swimming at all of those Brighton beaches. Mm. We've done a 24-hour readathon of his work. And that was designed to show that 24 hours is a long time and 365 days is really an eternity. So we're doing everything we can this week just in the hopes that people will learn a bit more about Evan, keep him in their thoughts, help us amplify our efforts on social media with the hashtag #IStandWithEvan. And it's a reminder he is still there, and therefore we need to redouble our efforts going forward.
Paul Beckett is a senior editor at the Wall Street Journal. He's part of an effort to release his colleague, reporter Evan Gershkovich, who has spent 1 year behind bars in Russia. Thanks for speaking with us again.
Thank you for all the support, Karen.
Spending time with family, donating to charity, abstaining from food and drink during daylight hours, these are some of the ways Muslims observe Ramadan. Live music is another part of the Islamic holy month. As the world's Duri Buscarin reports from Istanbul, the variety of music that's popular during Ramadan is a little different for everyone.
For the faithful, Ramadan begins before dawn, with a meal that many eat still half asleep, just before the first call to prayer. Then the fast begins. No water, no food until sundown. There are a number of exceptions, like if you're sick or traveling, but fasting can be hard, so cities like Istanbul put on live events to help people get through the day. Ibrahim Tashkram plays the daf, a shallow Kurdish drum. During Ramadan, he and his bandmates find themselves in high demand to play tasavvuf music, a genre that springs from Sufi traditions.
Bu ülkedeki Ramazan sebebiyle ve yani daha doğrusu İslam.
It's a traditional thing to play during Ramadan in this country, and probably has been for hundreds of years, Tashkram says. That's why people want to hear it. Tarek, his bandmate who asked not to share his full name because his day job is in the government, says the idea behind tasavvuf music is that some instruments are considered closer to God.
İslamiyet'in normalde enstrüman yasaktır. İşte sazdır, gitardır, kemandır.
Instruments with a pitch are forbidden, Tarek explains, like the saz or the electric guitar. In contrast, he says, two instruments are widely considered halal, a traditional drum and the ney, a reed flute.
İslamiyet'te çağrışım vardır ya, hani birazcık aykırı ya da İslamiyet'in...
We could play the other instruments, it wouldn't be a problem, but it's a way to respect and show interest in what people believe in, Tarek says. The trio chooses to play their Ramadan gigs with a stringed instrument called a kanun as well. In central Istanbul, listeners sit at picnic tables in a large tent set up by the city. There are just a couple of hours left before sundown, and two cousins in their early 20s are trying not to look at the time. Through a translator, one of them, Bensu Sarıkaya, says she's listened to tasavvuf music since she was a child.
Seviyoruz yani, huzur verici bir tarafı var bence.
That kind of gives me peace when I hear it. It's something that I'm used to.
Her cousin, Hatice Oruç, says it brings back memories of past Ramadans and of breaking the fast with relatives, friends, even strangers. She says it's a symbol of unity for her.
Yani dini olarak tabii herkesin görüşü farklı olsa da bir araya geliyor en azından.
Even if you have different opinions, you're still going to spend that time together.
At sundown, people head home for iftar, the meal to break the day's fast. And here in Kadıköy, one of the city's most popular areas for bars and live music, the streets empty out quickly. And that has an impact on secular musicians. For them, Ramadan slows down business.
Mesela Ramazan'dan önce daha fazla iş alıp o dönemi biraz daha...
Ali Baran Özcan plays guitar and bouzouki, a Greek lute similar to a mandolin. He says he tries hard to get extra gigs before Ramadan starts to save money.
Diğer müzikler biraz daha seküler.
At the same time, Özcan says, there are plenty of people in Turkey who aren't religious, who still want to go to shows during Ramadan. But artists who do perform face a backlash. As night descends, Turkish indie pop artist Gayesu Akyol takes the same stage that the traditional band performed on before sundown. Her style is eclectic. A throwback to the arabesque melodies of mid-century Anatolian rock mixed with a new age psychedelic pop.
Yani müziğini hem çok seviyorum hem çok güçlü ve feminist bir karakter.
I like that she has a unique style and that she's a strong woman and a strong feminist, says Ece İsmen, a fan. Akyol is a vocal proponent of human rights and the LGBTQ community in particular. 2 days after the show, a Turkish newspaper claimed that Akyol performing on a Ramadan stage was a scandal and a disgrace. But Akyol is no stranger to controversy. As if anticipating the criticism, she urges the audience to rise above it. I'm taking you on a vacation, she says. There's no economic crisis where we're going, no politics. Think of it as a utopia. We'll go and live happily ever after. For The World, I'm Jerry Buscarin, Istanbul.
Michelangelo's David is one of the world's most recognizable sculptures. If you haven't seen it in person, you have most certainly seen a reproduction of the well-chiseled figure of David on an apron or a fridge magnet or in a classroom.
To Florence, Italy now, a former Florida principal visited Michelangelo's David, the statue that led to her resignation after she showed pictures of the masterpiece to students in a lesson. One parent complained it was pornographic.
Curators at the Galleria dell'Accademia in Florence are mad too, but for a different reason. They say all of these reproduced images of the David are inappropriate. The museum's director, Cecily Holberg, has been on a mission since 2015 to stop the mass marketing that she says debases the iconic statue.
There was an art historian in the 16th century, Giorgio Vasari, and he said, "Who saw the David don't have to see other sculptures anymore."
At Holberg's behest, authorities in Florence have launched a series of legal actions using law protecting art from commercial exploitation. Holberg says the Accademia has won hundreds of thousands of dollars in damages since 2017. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Ocean currents are like giant conveyor belts moving massive amounts of water around the globe. They impact everything from the weather to fish populations. The biggest on Earth is the Antarctic Circumpolar Current, which circles around Antarctica. That current has sped up in recent years, and new research published this week in the journal Nature ties that acceleration to our warming world. Jennifer Middleton is one of the co-authors.
So the current strength itself is driven by the speed of the winds on the surface above the ocean. And the winds themselves are driven by the difference in temperature between the polar latitudes and those closer to the equator. So if you increase the temperature of the equator, right, and you build up a strong gradient, that's going to drive faster winds, and that in turn will push the current faster.
Bigger temperature differential between the poles and the equator means faster winds, which means faster Antarctic circumpolar current.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. And so recent research has shown that this current going around Antarctica is forcing warm water toward the continent, which is speeding up glacial melting there. Does this study suggest anything about the future then, whether, you know, we might see more of that melting as the temperature increases?
Yes. So our study has looked at past conditions on Earth's history when the Earth was warmer than today. And what we find during those periods is that Antarctic circumpolar strength is stronger. And associated with those intervals, we find a correlation with decreasing size of ice sheets when the current is stronger. And we believe that is because the current speeding up is bringing more warmer water from the deep ocean up to the polar surface and warming up the ice sheet.
So as this current moves faster and faster, it has an impact on ice on Antarctica. How does that work, and how does this current speeding up impact that?
As the current speeds up, the more warm water you bring from the depths of the ocean, the more heat you're bringing into interaction with the ice sheet on the edges of the continent. So as you continue to bring more and more warm water to the surface, that brings more heat to sort of melt the ice. And what we know from our past work is that we do see a correlation between periods of enhanced current speed and decreases in ice sheet. And we also see the reverse. We see periods where there's cooling relative to today during ice ages, for example, that we've seen the current strength has slowed down, and those coincide with periods of time when the ice sheet expands.
So in the past, higher temperatures have meant faster flow of this key current. Can we extrapolate anything then about the future?
Yeah, so there's no reason to expect that we won't see similar behavior moving forward with modern climate change. And our study is very similar to recent efforts that have observed the increasing strength in the current in modern conditions. So basically, our two studies combine ours using past insights into the current strength and other evidence that it's speeding up today suggests that it's pretty normal for this strength to increase when conditions are warmer.
So this study peered into history, basically, by looking at sediment cores from the bottom of the Southern Ocean to discover all this that we've been talking about. Can you tell us how that works, how you kind of read these cores to look into the past?
Basically, the sediment in the cores, we can use the grain size of the sediment there, so larger particles versus smaller particles, to indicate the strength of the current. And what we did in our study is we used chemical indicators of grain size to look at changes in the current speed over the past 5 million years. And over that period of time, we know from other records that we have changes in Earth temperature and ice sheet conditions. And so we can compare how the current speed at different periods in Earth's history when it's warmer and colder than today, how those compare to the variations in the ice sheets over time, and how that compares to changes in atmospheric CO2 and temperature conditions over time.
Jennifer Middleton is an assistant research professor at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. It's tax season here in the U.S., and taxes are also top of mind in Kenya right now. The country's government is trying to generate more revenue through big tax reforms, a.k.a. increases, and Kenyans are not happy about it. The World's Halima Gakandi reports from Nairobi.
In the Bible, there is a rich but greedy and corrupt character named Zacchaeus. In Swahili, Kenyans call him Zacchaeo. And these days, that's the nickname many have given their president, William Ruto, who entered office in 2022. Kwame Wino is the chief executive officer at the Institute of Economic Affairs in Nairobi. He explains this nickname is coming from the current administration's policies that involve a massive rise in taxes and tax enforcement.
Basically, people are seeing not just changes or reform in rates, but even a reform in how taxes will be collected and more intrusion into business affairs and even personal lives.
Taxes are being raised across the board, he explains, not only on income, but also on digital content creators, mobile money transfers, and on fuel. Now the government is contemplating removing tax exemptions on bread and milk, too. This has all brought weekly criticism from Kenyan citizens, commentators, experts, and, of course, opposition politicians. But President Ruto has said he doesn't mind.
I will do the right thing for our country, irrespective of what names people call me, including Zakaya.
Ruto says these tax raises are necessary to deal with Kenya's debt crisis and boost revenue for development projects. He acknowledges this will be hard for Kenyans, but necessary so the country doesn't rely on aid and debt.
Kenya will be built by Kenya, using our own revenues and our own taxes.
Most Kenyans, however, do not buy this argument. 30-year-old Joffrey Mwai works at a store in Nairobi that sells fashionable secondhand bags, clothes, and accessories imported from abroad.
Most of the businesses right now are struggling as a result of the higher taxation that we are experiencing.
He says the new tax increases, plus the high cost of electricity and utilities, are inflating costs across the supply chain.
The bag that you used to buy 1,000, like this bag that you can see there, is a laptop bag, a bag that you can use to put your laptop and documents. Today, you go and find it costing at around 2,000 Kenya shillings.
Today, that's roughly $15. He explains businesses are having to make tough decisions, like closing down, letting go of employees, or raising prices for customers who are already struggling to make ends meet. Mwai doesn't trust that the increase in taxes will result in better public services.
Every service in government today, nothing is working. Nothing is working in most of the agencies that you visit. And the government is collecting money? That's budgeted corruption. That's what I can say.
He points to Kenya's history of corruption in the government and recent scandals involving theft of public funds. A recent report from Kenya's Public Service Commission found that millions of dollars were lost through corruption, according to court cases prosecuted last year. Kwame Wino, the analyst, says the government needs to address corruption and the lack of public services if they want people to buy into their new tax policies.
It has to grow to actually give people confidence in this administration, because people think they're corrupt, and they are. People think they don't care, and people think they're right now just on a taxation grab.
Ultimately, he tells me, Kenya's revenue problem isn't a matter of not collecting enough taxes, but rather not using its money efficiently and honestly. While the tax raises might be unpopular among ordinary Kenyans, other African countries are looking at how they can follow suit. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Nairobi.
You're listening to The World. Radio in the UK was dominated by the BBC for decades, until 1964, when things changed.
Hello and happy Easter to all of you. This is Christopher Moore with the first record program on Radio Caroline. The first record is by the Rolling Stones.
How pirate radio shook up British airwaves. That's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Indonesia is the largest Muslim-majority nation in the world, but there is a sizable Christian minority. They make up 10% of the population. They worship Jesus Christ, or Yesus Christos, as he's known in Indonesia. And thanks to a long-awaited decision by the government, this weekend's Easter celebrations in Indonesia will be extra special. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
This church in Indonesia's capital is pretty small, but on Sunday mornings, it makes a big, joyous noise. The church's name is simply Christian Baptist Church Jakarta. It has about 100 worshipers. At this recent service, they're singing, "Jesus, I only worship you."
That name, Jesus, is very special.
Jeffrey Lee is the church's youth pastor. He's 43.
It's special because my parents teach me how to pray in the name of Jesus, Jesus Christus.
The name Jesus Christus has been sacred to Indonesian Christians for centuries, since the faith spread across the tropical archipelago 500 years ago. Today, most Indonesians are Muslim. Christianity is the second largest faith. But the government of Indonesia has long refused to accept the name Jesus. Officials have traditionally said, no, the Messiah's proper name is Isa al-Masih. Again, here's Pastor Lee.
We never use that name, Isa al-Masih.
That's because Isa al-Masih is the Quran's name for Jesus, the Messiah. In both the Bible and the Quran, Jesus is a prophet who performs miracles. But in the Quran, Jesus is not the Son of God, and there's no crucifixion. Both are essential elements of Christian belief. Andreas Harsono of Human Rights Watch says, over the years, Indonesian Christians have repeatedly put this question to lawmakers.
When the Christian want to call this person as Jesus Christus, why don't we follow what the Christian want rather than imposing the Arabic name?
It's never been illegal to say Jesus Christus in Indonesia, but in schools and on public signage and documents, the government has long insisted on using Isa al-Masih. So Easter would be the resurrection of Isa, even though in the Quran, Isa was not resurrected. Harsono says, for decades, the government has been aloof to the fact that this makes Christians uneasy.
Many Muslim politicians who are in power thought that it is not necessary to change the name.
Until recently, that is. As of January 1st, Indonesia does recognize Jesus Christus as the official name for Jesus. Easter is the first major Christian holiday since the change. Pastor Jeffrey Lee says Christians are very pleased.
I'm glad that finally they acknowledge our faith using Jesus Christus. This Easter is very special.
The change is seen as an olive branch toward Christians who, in some parts of Indonesia, have not fared so well. There are widespread reports of discrimination and of Islamist hardliner groups forcing churches to shut their doors, arguing they go against social harmony. There are even isolated cases involving physical attacks, occasionally killings. Pastor Lee says, fortunately, his congregation has never had any trouble.
When I walk into the church, I feel like I'm in my house, in my home. Feel very safe, and I can be myself, you know?
His church, he says, is their true sanctuary, a place where they never have to keep their beliefs quiet. In fact, they can belt them out. The Baptist church band sings, Allah, great is your name. Yes, the preferred name for God among Indonesian Christians is Allah, a word they borrowed from the Quran. Pastor Lee says, ultimately, people of faith are more alike than different, no matter what words they prefer. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
Every day, migrants cross from North Africa to Europe on small boats in the Mediterranean Sea. Many do not make it.
More than 100 rescued from this fishing boat that authorities say was packed with nearly 700 migrants when it overturned and sank.
These Pakistanis crammed into a small room by smugglers in Libya, some of them believed to be among the hundreds presumed dead.
It is the image of a lifeless child in the arms of a rescuer on a Turkish beach.
The news reports and images are haunting, and there's new data to go along with those individual stories. The UN's International Office of Migration now says last year was the deadliest of the past decade for migrants. Jorge Galindo is a spokesperson for the IOM.
We have seen considerable increases on regions such as Asia and Africa, reaching record levels since 2014. And the data is quite telling when we see that one in three people recorded as dead and missing on migration routes come from countries in conflict or countries who have been in conflict in the past 10 years or countries with big refugee populations. So that tells us that there is a growing need for enabling safe and regular pathways for migration for those people who are seeking asylum. We continue to see that the main cause of death in our database is drowning. Of course, the large majority are perishing on the Mediterranean. That is the single deadliest crossing worldwide, with over 28,000 deaths.
The IOM started counting migrant deaths 10 years ago after about 600 people died in two shipwrecks in the Mediterranean. But as you mentioned, there are other routes. Which are the most dangerous right now?
Well, the Mediterranean remains the most dangerous route for migrants worldwide. But as you know, when it comes to the Americas, there's also huge risks on migration routes. There's particular hotspots, such as the Darien crossing.
That's in Panama, going from South to Central America.
That's correct. The Darien crossing between Colombia and Panama. It's a major point of crossing for a lot of migrants, not only from Latin America, but also we see increasing numbers of people coming from Asia and Africa through that very densely forested area where people trek on for, you know, over 10 days to cross it. And the same we see at the U.S.-Mexico border, you know, since records are available, over 5,200 people have died just in the U.S.-Mexico border alone. These are areas that are remote, and so the large majority of people who have lost their lives, we have seen, are due to harsh environmental conditions, lack of adequate shelter, food, and water.
So are most of these folks seeking to migrate asylum seekers?
Well, not necessarily. One in three people that we have identified out of the 63,000 plus dead and missing of the last 10 years do come from countries in conflict. But there are others, of course, who are seeking perhaps only better economic opportunities. I think it's important to emphasize here that regardless of people's migration status and whether they have the right to claim asylum, they should be processed in a more predictable manner.
Mm-hmm. So I understand that the people who are doing rescues at sea and providing other humanitarian assistance for people who are migrating in harsh conditions has changed since you started studying this topic. So now it's nonprofits instead of governments. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the majority of search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean are conducted by NGOs. And we want to emphasize that it's important for governments to take a more leading role at sea, especially when we see that the number of flows have increased. Not only on the Mediterranean, we see a similar trend also on the so-called Western Africa Atlantic route to the Canary Islands. The number of arrivals are increasing. The methods employed by smugglers to transport these migrants are increasingly unsafe. And this is why it's important for states taking a leadership role in providing these search and rescue capacities.
From the perspective of these destination countries, what stops them from normalizing migration processes to make them more predictable and safer?
Well, this is a question for states, of course. What we want to highlight is that these are commitments that, you know, over 160 countries have signed on as part of the Global Compact for Migration. You know, there's a specific objective on saving migrant lives. And we recognize that countries have their sovereign right to protect their borders. We're not putting that into question. But migration cannot be managed alone by any single state. You know, there needs to be cooperation. And we need to abide by the commitments that we've made as part of the Global Compact, but also as part of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Unfortunately, the Missing Migrants Project is the sole indicator for measuring, you know, how we're doing in terms of that objective, you know, promoting safe and regular migration by the sheer number of deaths that we've recorded. And again, we see that 10 years on, there's still a lot to do. And this is why we always take the opportunity to call on our member states to, you know, continue working towards safer and regular migration that has benefits not only for the migrants and their communities, but also for countries of destination, if it's managed properly.
Jorge Galindo is a spokesperson for the International Office of Migration. He was talking about the IOM's new report called A Decade of Documenting Migrant Deaths. 60 years ago today, a pirate radio station revolutionized broadcasting in Britain. Radio Caroline had a novel location, a boat off the southeast coast of England. The station introduced millions of people in the UK to pop music. It also battled with the British government, the mighty BBC, and some pretty bad weather. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports.
A scratchy recording still exists of the moment Radio Caroline first went to air on the 28th of March, 1964.
Hello and happy Easter to all of you. This is Christopher Moore with the first record program on Radio Caroline. The first record is by the Rolling Stones.
At the time, bands like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles were becoming huge in the UK.
We were exporting the Beatles and the Mersey sound, but here at home, we seldom got to hear those pop songs because we only had the BBC.
This is Ray Clark, a presenter on Radio Caroline. He was just 9 when the station first came on air, but he still remembers what a struggle it was to find pop music anywhere on British radio before that day.
So we only had something like 2-3 hours of pop music a week. We couldn't even look with envy at you guys overseas because we didn't know such a thing existed as pop music radio.
The brains behind Radio Caroline belonged to an Irish man called Ronan O'Reilly. O'Reilly realised if he set up an unlicensed music station on a boat a few miles off the English coast in international waters, he could circumvent British law. He named the station Caroline after the daughter of President John F. Kennedy. Clark says the station's launch caught everyone off guard.
The government had no idea that Radio Caroline was coming, nor did the British public. But within 7 days, they reckoned they had an audience of 7 million people.
And over the next year, the number of listeners ballooned. The DJs would get bags of fan mail delivered to them by boat. Locals and tourists would take trips out to see them on board. And local news crews paid visits too.
Piracy, that's what's happening here, with the connivance of almost every teenager in southeast England at any rate. We're bound for Radio Caroline.
In 1966, Nick Bailey, who was just 19 at the time, did his first news reading shift on Radio Caroline.
Good afternoon, this is Nick Bailey with the news at 12 noon, London. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones are at the law courts in London today for their appeal against being convicted of drug charges.
Sometimes, Bailey says, reading the news while on a boat in the North Sea could be pretty challenging.
It could get very rough. So you'd have a situation where I'd be reading the news and one story I would see the sky and the next story I would see the sea.
Bailey, along with the other DJs, would work 2 weeks on and 1 week off. In between their shifts, he says, they'd play board games and smoke and when the weather was good, head out on deck and sunbathe. British director Richard Curtis made a film inspired by the pirate station in 2009. Called The Boat That Rocked.
In 1966, there were 571 American radio stations blasting rock and roll 24 hours a day. But in the country that gave you the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, the only way to hear the music was to tune in to a boat.
You are listening to Radio Rock and I'm the Count.
The film, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, was dismissed by a lot of Bailey's DJ colleagues as being way off the mark, he says. For starters, there were no women on board, but there were some things the movie got right.
The actual feel of what it was and the music we played and us sunning ourselves on deck. I remember Philip Seymour Hoffman when he said, you know, these are the best days of our lives, which for me, certainly, they were certainly one of the best days of my life.
But Bailey's time as a newsreader on a pirate station came to an abrupt end 1 year later. The UK government passed a law making it a crime for a British person to operate a radio station offshore or to advertise on one. By then, a number of other pirate stations had popped up off the UK coast. But the new rules shut most of them down almost immediately, and the BBC quickly decided to steal their thunder.
Here's news. Starting in September, the BBC begins a new service for fans of popular music. There'll be light. And then there's pop.
A month later, the BBC launched Radio 1, its first dedicated pop music station.
And good morning, everyone. Welcome to the exciting new sound of Radio 1.
The first presenter on the station was Tony Blackburn. formerly a Radio Caroline DJ. Radio Caroline struggled on for another year before it closed down because it could no longer pay the bills. But in the 70s, the pirate station started up again as a clandestine operation offshore. And over the next few decades, it continued to broadcast. Well, most of the time. When Ray Clark joined in the late 80s, he says he would often spend 7 weeks at a time at sea.
I've read the news with a brown paper bag in my hand and holding on desperately to the desk so that I didn't fall away from the microphone or collapse on the floor.
Today, Radio Caroline is a fully legal operation with a commercial radio licence, and Clark no longer needs his sea legs to go to work.
We actually broadcast from a building that was built by the American and British government for secret tests to try and evolve over the horizon radar to see what those in the eastern countries were doing. And better still, we use aerial broadcast masts that were once built by the BBC.
But once a month, Clark says, a handful of Radio Caroline presenters head out to a boat moored off the English coast and broadcast from there. We do it because we love it, he says. For the world, I'm Orla Barry.
COVID taught us a lot about indoor air quality, but scientists who study the pollution we breathe while we're inside say the problem still needs to be taken more seriously. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Lots of people pay attention to outdoor air quality, less so for indoor air quality.
Considering that we spend more than 90% industrialized societies indoors, there's nothing more important than paying attention to good indoor air quality.
That's Lydia Moravska, an air quality expert at Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia. She writes today in the journal Science that indoor air quality should be mandated in public places.
There are challenges, and challenges are significant considering the complexity of indoor environment. For once, we cannot bring an indoor monitoring station into each room. We cannot, for example, measure in one room in a building and then extrapolate this to other rooms. So we have to do measurements of some kind in every room, which means we must use technologies which allow this. But if you think about this, we already have monitors of some kind in every room, like, for example, smoke alarms.
So the WHO does have these indoor air quality guidelines, which are the same as the outdoor air quality guidelines. But you're saying there are not enforceable mandates or legislation in very many places. Is that right?
The guidelines as such, they don't have regulatory power. Every country has to do it itself based on the laws in the country. So until now, they basically have not been mandated standards. There have been countries which have some form of guidelines, even sometimes called standards, but they were not mandated. This movement now to mandate standards has begun. And in particular, for example, in Belgium, there is already law regulating carbon dioxide in public spaces in indoor air. But this is just the beginning.
In the meantime, are there ways that individuals can make sure that the air they breathe indoors is as safe as possible?
Well, that's right. Well, I'm saying that it is in principle responsibility for authorities to ensure that we have clean air. We can do things to protect ourselves. One of this is measuring carbon dioxide in indoor spaces. This is something which many people already do, and this has started during the pandemic. There are small monitors, really, of the size you can have them in the palm of your hand, and you can take them everywhere. This gives you information. If the concentration is high, well, there's no doubt that ventilation is inadequate.
It seems like better ventilation is the key to so much of this, and it seems like not that hard of a thing to achieve, especially since the pandemic started.
Well, this is a very, very good question. This is a very good question. And for centuries, experts were calling for the need for ventilation and explaining the role of ventilation. It is the value, I would say, what we put on our environment. Somehow we don't put enough value on indoor air quality. So that's probably part of the problem.
What do you do in your own home?
Well, our home is a 30-year-old small residential home, and it doesn't have sufficient ventilation. There's a problem in winter when windows are closed, not a good situation. But there's also an issue when outdoor air is polluted, which means future buildings have to be designed such that if there's pollution outside, mechanical system kicks in and air is filtered.
Lydia Morawska is an air quality expert and professor at Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia. Now, spellcheck and autocorrect can be super helpful, saving you from sending texts riddled with errors to your boss or a date you're trying to impress. But if that red squiggly line appears under your own name every single time you type it, that's pretty annoying. The world's Bianca Hillier reports on a campaign in the UK to make autocorrect more inclusive.
For many years, Jyothi Shah has dealt with spellcheck, flagging her first name as an error. She says Jyothi, spelled D-H-R-U-T-I, is often autocorrected to words like dirty. It's more than irritating, she says, and it impacts offline interactions too.
A colleague of mine messaged me saying, hey, isn't this really funny that your name autocorrects to Dorito?
Dorito, the tortilla chip.
And I was like, that is so super awkward. It made me feel quite uncomfortable about how do I say, well, no, it's not really that funny.
Shaw, who lives in London, says she started asking around and found many people struggling with the same issue. Non-Anglo names, even if they're common, often get that red squiggly line.
For example, there's an amazing woman called Montserrat. Her name changes to Munsterrat. How awful is that? There's a guy called Nana. His name changes to Nando's.
Nando's, the popular chain of chicken restaurants from South Africa. Now, Shaw and others dealing with this problem are trying to correct autocorrect with a campaign called I Am Not a Typo. In an open letter to tech giants like Microsoft, Apple, and Google, organizers wrote, "Our children should not be othered by the technology that is integral to their lives, and it's up to the arbiters of that technology to fix it."
That's the thing with this campaign. I am not a typo. I am me. And the message that really needs to go to the tech giants is, why is it that we don't belong?
Shaw says nobody from the campaign has heard a response from these tech companies. Microsoft, Apple, and Google also did not immediately reply to the world's request for comment for this story. But the research behind the campaign is clear. Organizers started by gathering public baby name data from England and Wales in recent years.
They put in these full lists of boys and girls' names into documents to identify how many incorrect names were identified.
Names including William, Nigel, and Louise passed the test, but 41% of the names were flagged as incorrect. These were largely names of African and Asian origin, and also some from the UK itself.
The percentage that they describe, that 41% figure, does not surprise me in the least.
Rashmi Dialchand is a professor at Northeastern University in Boston. She signed on as a supporter of this campaign and has done her own research on autocorrect's impact on non-Anglo names. Dialchand says part of her frustration now is that this problem should be an easy fix.
We see updates on our phones and in our software very frequently, right? Once a week, once a month, very frequently. And the algorithms should be able to make reference to those additional lists of more diverse names with relative ease.
For instance, every year the UK publishes a list of baby names. Advocates say tech companies could update their electronic dictionaries with that information. Apple has shown it can be done. Last year, the company announced that new software would stop auto-correcting swear words like the infamous ducking. Dialchand and others behind the I Am Not a Typo campaign are hoping for a similar treatment for their names. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studios. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other, and we'll see you here tomorrow.